You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, December 16th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Rare and wonderful, huh?
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
Rare and wonderful? What does that mean?
Okay, goodness. So it was the Hobbit animated movie from, I think, the late 70s, right?
Yeah.
Rankin and Bass.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the dragon.
That was Leonard Nimoy in that?
No.
Says something else.
No, that's something else more embarrassing than the animated one.
Yeah, so that is what the dragon says to Bilbo when he is saying, "Wow, your hide is amazing. Like, you know, your scales and everything are so awesome," because he's trying to sweet talk him, and the dragon comes back with "Rare and wonderful, huh?" The voice actor was
much
great.
Better delivery, though.
I see that stayed with you.
I have that movie memorized. Okay, so I admit.
Bob, did that line make it into the new movie?
Something similar. No, not really. Not that.
No spoilers. Haven't seen it yet.
Oh, for God's sakes, it's a book. It's a book everybody's read
100 times.
Spoilers don't count.
So, guys, I have some good news.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good news, everyone.
A listener of the show who comes from South Africa has offered for free to sign interpret our podcast for us.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Wait, Steve, are you joking about what happened at the Nelson Mandela funeral? Please be joking.
Maybe. Yeah, Jay, a South African sign interpreter has offered to do our show.
Just happened to offer to do sign language for a podcast.
Right, which would work really well.
That is awesome. So did you guys see this? Did you see it?
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so what we're talking about is some total nutcake somehow managed to get himself to be the main sign interpreter at Nelson Mandela's funeral, which was aired for 3 hours globally. And he's standing literally 3 feet from, like, the president of every country that you know, attended, including the United States. And, I mean, it was a ton of global diplomats up there. And the guy can't do sign language. Now, wait, I think he can do sign language. This is the last reading. But he was so drugged out that he was just mimicking sign language. Yeah, like he was having, like, from what I read, he was having a panic attack.
And
he was
on.
Well, he claimed he was having a schizophrenic episode, but the facts show that he has done this several times, and there have been many complaints about him that the government has ignored. So
this wasn't the first time. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't really hold water.
Well, think about it. What happened was a bunch of deaf people were watching, looked at the guy and said, that's gibberish. There is nothing there. He's not doing anything. And if you watch the video of him doing it, he repeats like the same four or five moves.
Well, on one channel, they had, like, in a little square digitally a sign interpreter. So there was him live and then the sign interpreter, the real one. So you could see that they had nothing to do with each other.
Oh, okay.
So anybody could see that he was not really signing.
But he had a few shticks, you know, like he would do like the same gestures over and over once you're paying attention. You know, if you watched it live, you might not really focus on him. And I could see how a lot of people just didn't even notice that it didn't look quite right.
He's like the troll of the century.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. Think about how far he went.
But he could have actually been signing. Yeah. It's so bad. He could have been signing whatever he wanted at that point. Like, imagine if he was actually saying crazy stuff.
So, Rebecca, tell us about December 21st.
December 21st, 1872, the HMS Challenger launched. Do you guys know about the HMS Challenger?
Oh, yeah.
It
blew up in space.
Not the non-HMS Challenger.
Not the USS Challenger.
The USS Challenger was named after the HMS Challenger because the HMS Challenger was the first official oceanographic scientific expedition launched, and it left England today. It embarked from Portsmouth, England, and it was meant to study the ocean floor. And it did. In fact, it came back with tons and tons of scientific data, so much data that it took almost 2 decades to publish all of the information that it brought back. Yeah.
Gee.
There were over 50 volumes in total, more than 29,500 pages in length. And this survey discovered tons and tons of new animal species. It explored the Pacific Ocean. It sampled 4,475 fathoms down, which is apparently the southern edge of the Mariana Trench, which we now know today, but they didn't know back then. So, yeah, it was a pretty incredible expedition, and it was the first of its kind.
Yeah, it was a military vessel, a Corvette-class ship. They took out most of the cannon and replaced it with scientific equipment. You know how many miles of rope they had on board?
I do not.
Miles.
144 miles of rope.
Why?
How many kilometers is that?
I don't know. And that's what they used to sound to the bottom of the ocean. They had to, lower it down with long ass ropes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Is it there yet? Not yet.
Unfortunately, the ship itself was, when it came back, nothing really much was done with it, and it was eventually sold for scrap, sadly. But the masthead.
That was like the equivalent of a Mars probe back then.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it was.
Right?
Hey, speaking of that.
From the bottom of the ocean?
Did you guys hear about China?
Why? What happened to it?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a little while. China's space exploration. But before we talk about China's space exploration,
but before
we're going to talk about geysers on Europa.
Geysers.
But it was such geysers a good segue.
Yeah, that was a good segue.
Yeah, it would have been.
I redirected your segue. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so guys, I don't know if you heard of it. Europa has moved up a couple of notches on the interesting scale. And it already had an impressive ranking on that scale. But
so it's up to 6.3 now?
Yeah, right. No, I use a different scale. So our buddy, the Hubble Space Telescope, recently saw evidence that geysers spewing water potentially exist on Europa. And if that's true, that would be the best evidence yet of a subsurface ocean on Europa. And it can make finding life on that moon even easier.
Mm-hmm.
So this was recently announced in a paper published by the journal Science. Plus, there was also a news conference about it recently at the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union. The effect of the potential geyser was spotted by the Hubble. Anything ejected off the surface of Europa would be bombarded by radiation that's all over that system. Europa does orbit within the radiation belt after all. So, and that radiation would then break up the water into its constituent hydrogen and oxygen atoms, and they would glow in the ultraviolet, which is what was specifically detected. So they're inferring that a geyser is what actually got that water up there. So Hubble looked last year, but did not see it. But it did see an occasional excess of hydrogen and oxygen in, you know, specific areas of the moon. I think it was in the southern pole. So they did find some evidence last year of this. Other observations, though, found nothing, however. But that actually supports the idea of a geyser. This was interesting. These previous observations that have occurred happened when Europa was at perihelion, or the closest approach to Jupiter. Now, if there were any cracks, you know, in the ice connecting the surface to the subsurface ocean, those cracks would be closed due to the increased gravitational pull and tidal forces from Jupiter. But at aphelion, or the most distant part of its orbit, things would kind of, you know, relax a little bit, and those cracks would open up and allowing the water to be squirted out. So that kind of supports it. It makes sense. If it happened the opposite, then they would be scratching their heads. And boy, does it squirt. To produce the amount of...
What the hell?
Oh, my God.
Wow, somebody make a note of things to clip out of Bob saying
wait.
He's out of context.
I didn't say spurt. I said squirt.
So yeah, we heard you.
It's not like squirt's innocent.
It's not better there,
whatever.
Bob.
So to produce... That's cool. To produce the amount of hydrogen and oxygen that was detected, they're estimating that would have ejected something like 7 tons of water per second. Now, this is assuming, you know, one geyser. It could have been two or more very closely spaced geysers, of course. So they're saying that this created a water stream traveling at, get this, 2,500 kilometers an hour, or 1,500 miles an hour.
Wow.
It's like, what, twice as fast as a jet? And reaching a height of 200 kilometers, which is 125 miles. So I tried to put that quantity of water into perspective. So I calculated that So imagine 25,454.5 average water hoses all together.
That doesn't
okay?
help.
Now,
that's,
yes,
that
I'm
analogy
done, but
does
I'm not,
not
done.
Help.
So you pinch all the nozzles so that the water coming out comes out fast, right? We've all done that. But you have to increase the increase the pressure though, so the output stays the same. And then just wait till it goes like 125 miles high. Now, of course, I'm ignoring the extra gravity and the air resistance on the Earth. But so that's my way of putting it into perspective. So
good job, Bob. Okay.
So yeah, there you go. Yeah,
it's all clear now.
Clear picture. Yeah. Now, what about the squirt?
Oh, come on, imagine 25,000 hoses. So this is great news, though, for multiple reasons. It shows that there's this potential interaction with the subsurface ocean and the surface, which is fantastic. So this could possibly bring material that was on the surface, and sometimes apparently the radiation that's all over Europa could create organic molecules, and that could then introduce them into the subsurface ocean, which would be one way, you know, to get that critical ingredient down there.
Bob, it's also possible that a giant sea creature from underneath the ice in Europa got squirted out this geyser and then fell back to the surface of Europa, and now we're sort of half frozen in the surface of Europa.
Yeah.
So when we land a probe there, there'll be like fossils sitting on the surface of the planet.
Yeah, we should keep an eye out for that.
That's slightly less likely, but still possible, I guess. So the most obvious benefit is this direct pre-created path to the ocean. Maybe it's not totally direct, but you've got a path going from the surface to the ocean underneath. So when we get there, we could potentially not need to do any drilling, or maybe minimal drilling, which is a fantastic advantage. And also, of course, don't forget, we would easily be able to sample water directly from the ocean underneath, right on the surface. So we wouldn't even have to drill to get some samples. And
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. We don't have to do any drilling because the planet's already squirting.
Right. It's already squirted. Yeah. Squirting.
Now, Bob, did any octopus-like creatures come out of the hole?
Well, the resolution is not high enough to detect anything like that.
Well, how about Cthulhu-sized creatures? Anything like that come out of the hole?
They did not detect any Cthulhu molecules. Not yet, anyway. But you got to remember, this is just the detection of hydrogen and oxygen atoms. That's pretty much it. No geyser was actually seen, like we've seen on Enceladus.
Enceladus.
Oh boy, yeah. No geysers were actually seen on like we've seen on Enceladus. So confidence is high though, but we can't be 100% certain, of course. And also, it's also possible that the friction between the different chunks of ice that could be moving around, they could potentially create reservoirs of water, and it's these small reservoirs that are feeding the plumes. So that would be kind of a bummer if we went all the way over there and found that out. So there doesn't necessarily have to be any direct contact between the ocean and the surface, assuming the ocean even exists at all. Regardless, though, this is very encouraging news, and I hope that it's encouraging enough that it will have an impact on NASA and kind of forcing it to approve the robotic mission to Europa that they've been talking about for a while, and a lot of people are excited about it, but it hasn't been approved yet. So hopefully this could be the final thing that says, all right, let's do it.
Did you guys notice the picture in that article? It says an image of Europa with the observations from Hubble superposed showing where ultraviolet light was seen. Click to embiggen.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've seen the word.
Oh, come on. You've never read Phil before?
That's Phil. Is that what you're reading on Phil's blog?
Yeah. The only.
But didn't Phil steal that from The Simpsons?
Yeah, but Phil uses it all the time.
Like almost.
But he's using it in a tattoo. But yeah.
All the time.
He sounds so angry.
Yeah, it's okay.
He's using it in such an official capacity. It's like, it was just, okay, so did it really become a word in the last 20 years?
Just on Phil's blog.
That's awesome, though. I love it.
Did you guys hear that there is a second language written into DNA?
Whoa. Is it English? Is it Esperanto? That's the joke I should have gone with. Steve, can you cut in my second joke?
Is it Esperanto?
And delete the first one. Yeah, the Esperanto one is way funnier.
It's like the DNA code, like the Bible code is another language.
What if it's is it sign language?
No. So this is like the worst science press release that I've read in a long time.
Why? What happened?
Which is saying something.
It's like one of those press releases that makes me mad. Because and
oh,
every
you won't like him when he gets angry.
Yeah, you've never seen me angry. So
I've totally seen you angry.
It took me, I couldn't, from any of the reports that were basically following the press release, I couldn't even figure out what the hell was discovered. I did have to go all the way back to the original article to really find out what the hell are they talking about here? Yeah, and most of the articles are like double meaning in genetic code or second language in genetic code. Scientists were shocked to discover that there was another language hiding in the DNA. What are they talking about? So it turns out that what they're talking about is that the base pair sequence of the DNA, which we know the primary purpose is to code for amino acid sequences of proteins, right? The trinucleotide code. But also that some of the nucleotide sequences are regulatory, right? They regulate the transcription of the proteins from DNA. That's the second language they're talking about.
What?
The regulation. Huh? So, okay, but that's not new.
Not at all.
Yeah, that's so what's new here? Again, I couldn't find out from the reporting about this news item what the new bit was. The new bit is this. And it's actually really interesting. If they had actually talked about that, I would have been excited. The new bit is what the scientists discovered is that some of the codons that code for amino acids, the part of the code that actually codes for the proteins, some of those codons, about 15%, also are regulatory. They're also binding sites for transcription factor, which is, what regulates when you start and stop the transcribing the proteins.
So they're performing double duty.
Yes. They're called duons because they're duops. Because they do both. So that's interesting. They could have just said that,
So, Steve, was this a result of the scientists misrepresenting or the press?
Who knows? I mean, the misrepresentation goes back to the press release from the University of Washington.
Oh, nice job, guys.
So I think that's where it all started. Who knows? And they're quoting the scientists, but they were, I don't know, they were probably just naive. And they didn't know how it was going to be translated to the public.
Well, Steve, let me guess, it throws all of evolution in doubt.
Yeah, well, they always do that thing where they completely overestimate and hype up how much we didn't know and how, flummoxed, baffled scientists are and surprised by this new stunning finding. They didn't know the code was there because it was hiding. It's just crazy.
Silly boffins.
The other thing is that because these codons are also regulatory sequences, that constrains their variability. So you know how there are multiple three-letter codes that code for the same amino acid. It's redundant. And there shouldn't be any selective pressure to prefer one amino acid variant over another, but there is. Some coding variants are highly conserved, and this is an explanation for why, which is something we also already knew in that it has already been demonstrated that certain coding sequences affect the transcription rate of a protein. And therefore, they're not completely silent. These mutations are not utterly silent. They may not change the protein, but they change the transcription rate of the protein. And so now what this new discovery is showing is the mechanism for that, because they are all there, these duons. They're actually binding sites for transcription factor. So this is, here's why this is a peeve of mine. It's not just because the press release was misleading. It's because I really enjoy it when a science news reporting or science reporting documentaries, whatever, take the approach of walking you through the sequence of discovery and the thought process of scientists. It's like, this is what we knew. This is what we thought. This is what we didn't know. And then we made this new discovery, and this is how it fit into this evolving picture of our scientific understanding.
That's
cool. I love that. And so I eventually was able to piece this into our sequence of understanding of how regulation and transcription works. And this is an exciting little new piece. And that's the story they should be telling. Instead, it's like, we knew nothing, and now, this totally throws everything into disarray. They concoct this ridiculous story about how little we knew before and how totally transformative this is, when in fact the more interesting story is the opposite, is that this is an incremental piece of information, but it's like a puzzle piece that's fitting into an existing puzzle. So they just totally get it wrong, and it rubs me the wrong way, because the missed opportunity to tell the real story of science here and how cool it is. You know, you guys have seen science documentaries that do it right. And then you see, and it's so cool.
Couple.
I was recently, this is a kind of a tangential topic, but somebody recently recommended to me on the History Channel the show Big History. Have any of you guys seen this?
Yes, I have.
No.
I watched it last night.
Isn't it horrible? I mean, is it just me?
It's
unwatchable. I thought I was led to believe that this was going to be like Connections, like James Burke's Connections, which is wonderful, wonderful series. If you have never seen either Connections or The Day the Universe Changed, watch them. Get them on DVD or whatever and watch them. And I was, oh, good, big history, like how the unique things connect throughout the history. But it's horrible. It's everything I hate about a documentary. That the style is, it's, you know, so superficial. Like I just watched the episode on gold. And it's like two-thirds of the way through the show, and I've learned that gold is shiny, and people use it as money. Did you know that?
Wait, let me write this down. Hang on.
It's shiny. Oh, my God.
Horrible. Anyway, this press release was kind of like that. It was just everything wrong about how to report science.
Steve, can you pronounce the last name of the doctor who led the research team there?
No.
Okay, just checking. It only has about 450 characters.
All right, let me try. Hang on. I got to embiggen it so I can read it here. It's Stamatoyanopoulos. I think I got that right. Yeah,
no. It wasn't so bad.
John Stamatoyanopoulos. All right. Finally, Rebecca, you can tell us about the Chinese going to the moon.
China has landed a rover on the moon this past weekend. The Jade Rabbit.
Is that so Chinese? The Jade Rabbit? I mean, come
landed
on.
In the Bay of Rainbows.
Now, wait.
Are there unicorns in there?
No, the eagle has landed, but the Jade Rabbit is in the Sea of Rainbows?
It's way better. The Bay of Rainbows. The Jade Rabbit has landed in the Bay of Rainbows.
Didn't it miss its target, though?
No. I mean, it seems everything I've read made it sound like it went.
It's on the edge. It's on the edge of its range. It did miss its original target, but it's still on the edge of the area where that was acceptable. And it's supposed to be in whether by accident or not, in a more interesting area than it was actually originally supposed to be.
All right. Well, I'll consider that the end of the rainbow then.
Yes, the name of the rover is Jade Rabbit, or U2, which refers to, as does the name of the lander is Chang'e, and it refers to a really nice romantic fable that exists in China, and variations of it exist in other cultures as well, about, like in American culture, Western culture, we have the idea of the man in the moon. But many other cultures see a rabbit in the moon. And so the Chinese fable is that Chang'e was a woman who stole a medicine to make a person immortal from her husband. And she escaped to the moon with her pet rabbit, known as the Jade Rabbit. And the Jade Rabbit makes the medicine for her as she lives on the moon. Yeah, it's a nice little fable and pretty much a cool thing. Like, I think most people who are into space, space exploration and exploration of the moon, I should say, see this as a positive development, because China's only now the third country to make it to the moon. And this is the first time anybody has put something on the moon since the 70s.
40 years almost, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a huge deal.
For a soft landing, we should say. We've crash landed.
A soft landing, yeah. You know, there are things that this rover will be exploring that a lot of researchers are looking forward to getting the data for, mostly related to, it seems like it's focused mostly on what lies beneath the moon's crust, beneath the moon's surface, I should say, and also the formation of craters on the moon and the moon's volcanic history. So these things are very interesting to scientists, and so they hope to get some good data out of this. And also I think that there's a little bit of hope that this is going to spur other nations to conduct research on the moon and get them to get more into space research as a whole and start launching things up there, which will, you know, a little competition could possibly do some good for organizations like NASA. On the other hand, there is a bit of an issue with the fact that China has yet to sign on to the code of conduct that the European Union has put out. Everybody except for China, Russia, and India have signed on to it. It's basically just a set of rules for how you are to behave in space. And that includes weaponry.
No pushing.
Yeah, of course, you know, common courtesy things like which spoon to use.
When to hold the door open. Yeah.
Well, they're not going to knock down our flag, are they?
So what are they not doing that?
Well, China simply hasn't signed on and refuses so far to sign on to that code of conduct. China and Russia have made their own version of the code, but that version of the code exempts missile use from the ban on space weapons, which other nations are seeing as kind of a big deal. So, yeah, there's a bit of a worry with how is China going to enter the space age? Is it going to be a net good in terms of human knowledge or a net loss in terms of having a country whose record on human rights isn't exactly stellar, now having better technology that could possibly be used for ill? But by and large, most of what I've seen has been very positive, mostly because of the scientific research that's going to come out of this. So good job, China.
Did anybody else look for anyone stating that this is a hoax?
Oh, yeah. That's already happened. Yeah. There are several very funny blog posts and YouTube videos from people criticizing the lack of dust thrown up by the lander. You know, it's a lot of the same stuff that we see still for the moon hoax deniers, moon landing deniers, I guess I should say, not moon hoax. Anyway, yeah. It's yet another, why is there no streaming live feed? And, you know, just nitpicking on various things. It's ridiculous.
Also, Iran put their second monkey up into orbit. Aww. You guys know that? So Iran's got a space program going.
Did not know that.
I knew they had a space program. I didn't know how far they'd gone with it.
Monkey number two. That's how far they've gone. So yeah, he's seeing the proliferation of space travel, which I think overall is a good thing. And hopefully it'll be a kick in the ass, you know, to NASA.
And private companies.
Yeah. I think it's all good.
If we keep cutting. Yeah. Unless our country keeps cutting these budgets for these things, which we have a habit of doing lately.
Well, that's,
we're not going anywhere.
That's the idea, is that if there's, I mean, the competition with the Soviet Union spurred a lot of spending on space exploration back
like
in the 60s,
yeah.
50s and 60s. So yeah, why not?
All right, Evan, I've been reading on the internet that aspartame is going to kill me.
Oh, you are correct.
The internet didn't lie to me, did it?
No, of course not. How could it possibly lie to you when you have people like Joseph Mercola saying, you're familiar with him? You know, he's the osteopath turned alt med guru and vitamin nut. So Here's a little thing from his website. I don't have to go too far back in time. November of 2011. Aspartame is by far the most dangerous substance added to most foods today. And why is that? Well, because the following chronic illnesses can be triggered or worsened by ingesting aspartame. Brain tumors, multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, chronic fatigue syndrome, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, mental retardation, lymphoma, birth defects, diabetes, fibromyalgia. That's pretty bad.
Scary.
So if you just fast forward a little bit, say to now, the BBC has reported that the European Food Safety Authority, which is the equivalent to the United States' Food and Drug Administration, so the EFSA has reported that aspartame poses no threat to human health. And that also includes the breakdown products of aspartame, which are aspartic acid, phenylalanine, and methanol. Yes. So the doctor, Dr. Mortensen, Alcia Mortensen, who chaired the EFSA's aspartame review panel, said, "The opinion represents one of the most comprehensive risk assessments of aspartame ever undertaken. It's a step forward in strengthening consumer confidence in the scientific underpinning of EU food safety, of the EU food safety system and the regulation of food additives." For those of you who don't know, aspartame is a commonly used artificial sweetener and sold under the brand names NutraSweet or Equal. And it's composed of amino acids, aspartic acid, and phenylalanine. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins that are found naturally in many foods. And it's used because it's about 200 times sweeter than sugar. So much less of it can be used to give the same level of sweetness. Thus, in turn, it lowers the calories in food or beverage, which is why it's prominent. It's predominant in, you know, diet sodas and other things that are regularly consumed. So what's going on here? How can it be that aspartame can trigger deadly illnesses and at the same time, upon a systematic review of the scientific evidence, cause no ill effects?
Because Mercola's an idiot, that's how.
Come on, give him a chance, Steve. All right, no, he's an idiot.
I think he's had enough.
These byproducts, or you know, what it breaks down into, they're naturally present in other foods, fruits, vegetables. They contain aspartame, essentially, the aspartic acid and the methanol. They're all in there. They're processed in the body the same way as those derived from the other dietary sources. And by comparison, the amounts, the components ingested from food and drink containing aspartame, they are relatively small. For example, go ahead and have a serving of non-fat milk, and it provides 6 times more phenylalanine and 13 times more aspartic acid than compared to an equivalent amount of diet beverage sweetened with aspartame.
Yep, I once read an estimate that if you wanted to overwhelm your body's ability to safely metabolize aspartame, you would have to drink the equivalent of about 60 gallons of soda a day, every day.
For a long time. Yeah. For a long time.
Yeah. The safety limits set by the FDA and other regulatory agencies like the European Food Safety Authority are way above what anyone can reasonably get in their food or drinks. But if you look at, you know, so this is all toxicology questions. You get the toxicology literature that shows all the horrible things it does. Like if you put it directly onto cells in a petri dish or you give mice overwhelming doses of it. But the issue is always, the dose makes the poison, right? Or the dose makes the toxin. So what, in the doses that people are going to get exposed to in real, in vivo, real life situations where it gets metabolized, et cetera, what are the net health effects? And it's just in the background. It's nothing. You know, these breakdown products are breakdown products of lots of stuff. You know, we talked about formaldehyde before, how that sounds scary. You have formaldehyde in your body. It's a breakdown product of just metabolism, of food, of stuff that you eat. So it's nothing. It's just, as you say, it's just amino acids. Unless you have phenylketonuria, you have nothing to fear.
PK,
yeah,
PKU,
from
phenylalanine,
from aspartame. There is this persistent question, though, of can aspartame trigger headaches? And the literature on that is still a little mixed, although there are some studies that show that a subset of people who believe that their headaches are triggered by aspartame probably can have like an actual migraine triggered by aspartame. And that makes sense.
That's called placebo.
Well, right? I mean, some people believe they can be, but they get triggered by placebos just as much as aspartame in blinded studies. But a subset does look like they get their migraines can be triggered by aspartame. But migraineurs can have migraines triggered by lots of foods. It doesn't mean there's anything dangerous or unique about aspartame. You know, some people get their migraines triggered by, you know,
chocolate,
red
my
wine,
poor aunt.
Chocolate, which is supposed to be wonderful for you. But yeah, it's just, there are some common triggers, but people have their unique quirky triggers as well. It says more about, you know, that person than the food, than the safety of the food itself. And it has nothing to do with any other risk. It's just, it's a sometime migraine trigger. That's about the worst thing you could say about it.
Steve, wouldn't you think also that there would be a massive response if aspartame was so dangerous and deadly that we would know with 100% proof?
Oh yeah, you have to weave a conspiracy theory in order to say that it's this horrible toxin that's being covered up, and not just by the FDA, but like every regulatory agency in the world. You know what I mean? There's no regulatory agency that has looked at all the data and come to a different conclusion that, you know, that it's not safe.
Part of the conspiracy.
Yeah, there has to be a worldwide conspiracy.
There you have it. It's safe.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Whew. Yep.
could drink that all that diet soda.
I know. I'm so, you know what? I'm quite happy.
It's at least aspartame's not as dangerous as using a cell phone on a plane, right, Jay?
Well, you'd like to think. Nice. Yeah. So what is the cell phone thing on airplanes? What was the history? Why are we in this situation? Why can't I talk to my friends when I'm on a 6-hour flight?
Because you don't have any friends.
Exactly. Oh, you stole my joke. So did you guys know that personal electronic devices, or also called PEDs, were initially banned on an aircraft or in aircrafts in general in 1961?
Are people who love their PEDs pedophiles?
Oh, boy. So, Jay, they had electronics back then?
Yeah, they did. Well, there was a result. This was the result of a study conducted by the RTCA, the Radio Technical Commission for Aeronautics, which is a nonprofit private company that the FAA and the FCC have used for decades to do independent research. So this company serves as a federal advisory committee which conducts studies on navigation, air traffic management systems, communications, and surveillance. So the RTCA has found that although extremely low, the chances of interference from PEDs is most risky during takeoff and landing. And this was the initial study that was done in the 60s that kind of put the fear out there. I don't know how heavily it was acted on, because I just don't think there were a lot of people that had personal electronic devices at that time to, you know, enough to really worry. But as technology evolved and more people started to get them, in 1991, the FCC, so roughly 22 years ago, the FCC then put a ban in place. And the reason why was because they were worried, not because that it was really interfering with the avionics, but because they were worried that it was going to overwhelm the cell towers and disrupt cell service. So imagine this. Right now, your cell phone might be in contact with 1, 2, maybe 3 towers. It all depends on how far away they are from you. And I know that there's a lot of software that goes involved. You know, it's involved with the exchange of, you know, going from one tower to another and all that. But in essence, your phone is connecting to the cell towers and it's on the network. But your phone isn't connecting to all the towers because there is something in regards to distance, line of sight, and all that with your cell phone. Now, if you're up at 40,000 feet, your phone can suddenly see and connect to dozens, hundreds, I don't know. It's just, it could overwhelm the network. Now, of course, not just one phone, but if you have, say, 50,000 people who are in the air and they're all connecting to hundreds of towers, this could theoretically overwhelm the system or the system that we had, say, 5 years ago and before. But now they believe that because of recent technological advances that maybe that's not going to be an issue anymore. So the FCC is the real culprit here in blocking us from using our cell phones on airplanes. So on Thursday, the 12th of December, 2013, the FCC voted to publicly review the cell phone ban. And this doesn't mean that we're all going to be talking up at 40,000 feet soon. This review could take some time. I think their initial time span on it was a month to get the initial public talking done and everything. But, you know, this is going to be a while. There's a lot of debating that's going to go on around this and for a lot of different reasons. So I don't think that it is irresponsible for them to review the ban. I also think that we really need to 100% validate whether or not electronics truly can disrupt avionics on airplanes. I know that the Mythbusters did a study, but they did a limited study. They only used one type of device that airplanes use to communicate to the ground. You know, now a lot of airplanes are moving into GPS tracking, and then they're not sure, you know, if it's going to interfere with the GPS tracking or not. I absolutely wouldn't take that TV show as, okay, this proves or disproves anything to a degree where we're going to change the law, but it could give a nudge in a direction. And I think what it did was it made us realize that we need to do more testing. And I don't understand why there hasn't been an enormous amount of testing done on this, probably because it's phenomenally expensive. There's so many cell phones out there. Every year, new cell phones are hitting in the market. They probably have to test this stuff like crazy.
That's the thing, Jay. I mean, part of the reason for the ban was that they just didn't want to have to test every carrier, every model phone, which is constantly – they would be constantly testing new models. So they just said, oh, screw it. We'll just ban the whole thing rather than having to test it all.
I agree with that. I'm fine with that. It even initially, you know, now we can revisit this. I don't know where the money's going to come from, but if the FCC is opening the door to reanalyzing the data, perhaps even ordering new data, I'm for it. You know, as long as it doesn't you know, break any budgets or do anything ridiculous with money. The now to continue on with the story, though, on the same day last Thursday, Anthony Fox, who's the transportation secretary of the Department of Transportation in the United States, was leaning toward their own ban to protect aviation consumers. And I'm not sure if that protection was for the physical safety of passengers on airplanes or more of the emotional safety. Now, get this. So there's a lot of people that are saying that they're worried about disruptions on airplanes, meaning that, okay, there's going to be people that are on like these 6 hour, 12 hour flights, even longer. You know, you fly from the United States to Australia, you're on a plane for 16 to 22 hours or whatever. It's a huge flight. Imagine sitting next to someone who's talking to their BFF, about, oh, I don't know, whatever, something that completely annoys you for 3 hours, you know, nonstop. You know, that's,
put your headphones on.
Yeah, but still, Steve, what if you're sitting right next to the person? I can understand that. I typically don't have disruption from people that I sit on airplanes with conversation wise because they're usually not having, they're not engaged in a lively conversation right next to me. In the times that it's happened, I agree, I've put my headsets on, but what if the whole plane was doing it? What if, you know, half the plane was involved in phone conversations? I'm not even sure how disruptive it would be, but they
can
study.
Can we just text each other?
Yeah, nobody likes talking on the phone anyway.
I know. People just text anyway, especially kids. They don't talk.
Now, there are organizations out there that are already asking for this law to not be, you know, the ban to be removed. I know that the flight attendants or the organization that manages flight attendants, they were saying that they're worried that they think that there could be conflicts between passengers on airplanes. You know, I don't doubt that either. You know, you never know. Somebody gets pissed off at somebody else about a phone. Next thing you know, there's a fist fight on an airplane. That's bad. So I think these things need to be studied. They could test it. They've already tested using letting full airplanes allow their passengers to talk on cell phones. Other countries other than the United States have allowed limited use or you know, certain flights are allowed to do it or whatever. It happens. This has been done many times to the point where I think we can say that, you know, planes aren't falling out of the sky because of it, at the very least. And at best, I have never heard any major complaints about conflicts between passengers on those flights. But they could do a limited study. They could roll it out. Maybe one airline can test it temporarily and see how it goes and even have people on the flights analyzing the passengers and see what the reaction is. You know, you interview people after the flight. There's a ton of things that they could do. But what I'm curious, though, what do you guys think? All of a sudden, let's say that in a month they were going to lift the ban.
Yeah, do it.
Do you have a gut reaction?
We'll sort it out. Yeah, well, my gut reaction is we'll see what happens and we'll work it out. That's my gut reaction.
Yeah, I don't think that there would be anything tragic, you know, immediately happening. I think the worst that will happen is like some mild inconvenience from people grumping about it. But who cares? Get over it.
New social protocols will come into existence. But Jay, did you mention that recently the FAA lifted their ban on personal electronic devices under 10,000 feet?
That to me is the biggest thing.
That's cool. That's awesome.
I flew the weekend that it happened. It's only two airlines, as of last month had instituted. I don't know if more have, but one of them was Delta, who I fly all the time. And I cannot even explain to you what that did for my mental state flying, just being able to keep my music on during the whole taxiing and like, the
gate to gate
stuff.
To watch your movies, listen to music. Yeah, it's awesome. Although I recently flew to Canada. Canada's still under the old rules. So landing in Canada, I had to turn off my electronic device.
Boo.
There have been some studies looking at cell phones and safety. There are mainly like case reports of pilots reporting their equipment going haywire and correlating that to allowing or disallowing electronic devices being turned on.
Yeah, but that's anecdotal. I don't trust that.
It's not definitive. It's not definitive. But there have been some more controlled studies on the ground. I guess they haven't done any controlled studies in the air that I could see, but they have done them with jets on the ground and no effect. They have not seen any effect of the cell phones on the equipment. So it's, I don't know, it's a little bit of an open question. It seems like it'll probably be safe, but, it is theoretically possible for a lot of cell phone signals in the plane to disrupt GPS, for example, or to disrupt, you know, some of the communications equipment in the cockpit.
That's testable. I mean, this is not something strange.
Yeah,
I agree.
It boils down
get
to
up
money.
There and start testing. Are all these things generating that different a signal that they do have to test each of these things individually? Can't they just bring up massive devices that emanate lots and lots of these signals? I mean,
Well, I think part of it is that it's
I'm not seeing
without any regulations, without any gates for them to jump through, then any company could develop a device that could damage avionics or disrupt avionics. I mean, you could walk onto a plane with a device that does it if you built one, right?
They're you could all you could also walk onto a plane that will block cell phone signals, and no one who will know.
Good point.
It would be nice to be able to get email and text messages, though, on the airplane. I mean, even if they said, okay, yeah, no talk or limited talk time, maybe they'll have talking windows where you could talk on the plane. If it's a 6-hour flight, you know, an hour and a half is okay to talk, whatever. That type of thing I would think is fine.
All right, Evan.
Steve?
Who's that noisy?
Who is that noisy? Let's
fill
play last
in.
Week's. Yeah, let's do it right now.
You are free to believe me or to disbelieve, but please take my word on it that I am not joking. This is very serious, a matter of importance. At that time, I had no idea what I was seeing. It resembled nothing that I had ever heard described. It resembled plasmic energy. It had colors. It moved fast. It collected and then dispersed.
So didn't that guy contradict himself twice in that brief statement? Don't take my word for it, but believe me.
Yeah. Rather peculiar logic.
Then he said, it resembled nothing I'd ever seen before. It resembled a plasma.
Well, maybe he's never seen plasma before. He read about it.
Yeah, maybe he's only heard it described.
I imagine this fellow's a well-read person because that was, in fact, Philip K. Dick.
Oh. P.K. Dick.
P.K. Dick. Let's see.
I do enjoy him as a science fiction writer.
Yeah. Let's see. What short stories has he written? Oh, a couple ones you may have heard of. I don't know. Blade Runner. I don't know. Total Recall. Minority Report. Any of those ring a bell? I don't know.
Yeah. He's a good writer.
For Blade Runner, yeah. Wasn't it do
Android's Dream of Electric Sheep.
Electric Sheep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was the name of the book. And then they
weird
story. That ain't going to work in a movie. Yeah. Very weird story. Very weird story. He was a weird guy. Obviously, because he talked about a lot of different things. And I guess in this particular piece, in this lecture that he was giving from 1977, he has this idea that reality is this pernicious illusion and a repressive and authoritarian matrix generated in a dream factory where we should be tearing things down in order to see things as they really are to get to the truth.
What a scary world some people live in.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they do. Although, I don't know, was he a little ahead of its time? And because we've talked about on the show, how do we know that we're not in some kind of grand simulation and tests are being, scientific experiments are being run to try to answer that very, very question. So there's a little bit of legitimacy, I think, into some of these ideas, but he intertwined it with a lot of mysticism, spirituality, religious overtones, and several other things that really don't fit well, play nice with science. So it's kind of a mixed bag, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Anybody get it?
Several people got it.
Several.
But there can only be one. There can only be one winner each week. Aurora Geertz, G-E-E-R-T-S. Aurora, you are this week's winner. Congratulations.
Congrats.
Well done. All right. And with Aurora, she is now officially the final contestant in our year-end wrap-up Who's That Noisy contest, in which we've accumulated all the winners from all the weeks we've played Who's That Noisy. We're putting all their names into a hat, and we're going to select one to be the grand prize winner. That grand prize winner is going to be joining us in 2014, one of our episodes, to play science or fiction with the rest of the rogues.
Cool.
And we will be drawing that name next episode. So something to look forward to. Hey, and speaking of next episode, I have another noisy. We're going to play the next Who's That Noisy for you, and we will reveal it during the first show in the new year. So you're going to have extra time to guess this one. Here we go. Okay, I'd like to give our audience a hint with this one. This is the most, well, uncomfortable Who's That Noisy I think I have ever played.
Really?
All right, so WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email, or the forums, sguforums.com. Go ahead and put your answer there. Give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
All right, thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
We're going to do one email this week. This email comes from Brian Sheely from Lafayette, Colorado. That's in the United States. Did you know that, Evan?
I did know that.
Okay.
He writes, 76 became a state.
He writes, I stumbled across this website long ago. You really had that date on the tip of your tongue?
Yeah, because I was watching a documentary recently about about the expansion of the United States, and cool. Colorado was one of the subjects. So there you go.
Brian writes, I stumbled across this website long ago. In a recent discussion over on Doubtful News, I brought up this site as an excellent example of audio pareidolia. Then I went back and took a closer look because the website appears to have changed significantly since I last looked. Now he is selling reverse speech as a service that has reportedly warned another CEO of a possible hacker or other criminal presence in a high level of his company. In the words of his own hidden voice channel, an arch felon, or arc felon, depending on how which way you swing. This quote scared the crap out of me, and as it implies, someone may have lost their job due to pareidolia. I feel sick reading this, thought you guys might like a look. And he links to reversespeech.com. You guys taking a listen to this?
Yeah, this was actually a little bit scary. Reverse speech is audio pareidolia. Obviously, but it's brought to an absurd level and possibly a dangerous level as well. So the idea is that with pareidolia is that your brain is wired to tease meaning out of sound, just like it is for finding faces in clouds and burnt toast. So it's very similar to the visual pareidolia that we so often talk about. But this guy, David John Oates, he's the 20-year pioneer of reverse speech. On his website, it's this discovery is it's described as the seventh sense, and it's also described as being of Nobel caliber. I don't know who is actually doing that describing, but I wouldn't trust anything else he or she has to say about it. So his breakthrough apparently is the idea that normal speech is composed of the usual words we hear and interpret, but also unconsciously integrated into that is this backward speech that if analyzed properly using his training and software, you could determine hidden motivations and hidden meanings, information, and ultimately the truth apparently comes through. So the idea is that the forward speech that we're all used to is a product of the conscious mind. It's the conscious mind speaking, and this reverse speech is the unconscious mind speaking. He offers all sorts of things on his website, training courses, a whole bunch of those he was selling for about $500. There's books, ebooks, there's reverse speech analyzing software, and apparently at some point he was also selling the hardware to do this reverse speech analysis, but they don't sell that anymore because everything is digital now, of course. So, you know, I poked around. I couldn't find, you know, and wasn't surprised. Couldn't find any good evidence that that reverse speech actually exists as he describes it. There's really nothing there to hang your hat on at all. And no matter how you look at this, it's just out and out silly. I mean, what would the evolutionary pressure be for selecting that ability anyway? You know, right? How would that even, you know, why would your brain devote precious, you know, oxygen to something like that?
Yeah, think about how horrifically complicated it would be, you know, to have, what algorithm is running in the brain that it's encoding backward speech in our forward speech.
And what kind of grammar, you know? Apparently it's not, and apparently the backward speech is related to what the forward speech is saying. But like I said, it's supposedly what you really mean by what you say. If you can analyze it using his techniques.
So Bob, they of course have this on tape, right? All they have to do is reverse what you're saying and you could hear it.
Yeah. The software just lets you, manipulate sound files and of course reverse them. I mean, it doesn't sound too difficult to me. Just play it backwards. But I guess you could do all sorts of things with the software, to as you train and learn how to develop your technique
tease that signal out of the noise.
Exactly.
Mine the data.
Yeah, I mean, and the obvious thing here is that with all this, not just reverse speech, but also just figuring out, you know, what random static or random noise means, like these ghost hunters, whether it was the EVP, electronic voice phenomena, it's the same thing. You listen to it and you could, you know, you're finding patterns in the sound. I mean, your brain is exquisite at doing that. And the key, though, is, and the best demonstration I ever had, I was listening to a Skeptoid episode, and they played these nonsense phonemes to see what you made of it, and I really couldn't hear anything. But then Brian said, "This is what this is saying. You know, imagine it saying this," and he said a sentence. And then once I listened to it again, my brain snapped right into that interpretation of what he said, and I couldn't not hear it anymore. So your expectations have a huge, huge effect on how you interpret anything, whether it's just nonsense phonemes or backward, any type of backward speech or anything like that. There was an experiment in 1998 that had subjects listen to what Oates has audio taped, and those that were told what to listen for, of course, had much, much more success than those who weren't. And that, so expectation plays into this so much. Mm-hmm. So, but the danger is kind of scary. At his website, like I said, he believes that this reverse speech always tells the truth. He describes it as the ultimate lie detector test. He advocates, employers using it for employee selection, lawyers using it for deposition analysis, reporters using it for to understand politicians' speeches and things, and that's
awesome.
and you just imagine what else it could be applied to. It's really, really scary to think that yes, I know what you really meant by what you said, and it totally reminds me of, and I'm sure you've been thinking these words, the facilitated communication.
Yeah,
it's very similar to that, and we've talked about that in the past, and all the harm that's wrought. It's just scary. I mean, false accusations of sexual abuse, people going to jail just from facilitated communication, and this would be very, very similar to that. If anybody took this seriously and tried to make it mandatory for employers to use or lawyers, I mean, that's just so scary that we would ever even approach that direction. And of course, if it took off, Oates would love it because he, of course, sells the training and all the e-books and training manuals and even the software in order to make you proficient at it. So he would make a bundle if this became widespread, which I hope it never ever does.
Yeah, fortunately, it seems to be pretty fringy.
Yeah.
Shlomi doesn't have the reach that facilitated communication had. Yeah, it's just, it's more mining data to look for patterns and, teasing it out. It's also, this desire to have the back channel to the truth. You don't want to have to do all the hard work of
very
analysis
compelling,
and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
This way, this just gives you instant access to the absolute truth. We love that shit. It serves our need for control and certainty,
But it's worse than that, Steve, because by the method that Bob was talking about, it sounds like he's even controlling the result that he's getting.
Yeah, it's not just pattern seeking, it's pattern manufacturing. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Dangerous.
Well, as a little demonstration, I took the liberty of taking a short segment from Bob's presentation on this topic. So something he just said a moment ago, I reversed it, which in Audacity is really easy. You just hit the reverse button. So let's take a listen to it. Tell me if you hear anything in Bob's reverse speech. I think I catch a phrase which you could argue has some application to the topic at hand. But we'll just let our listeners at home see what they hear. Let us know if you hear anything in the speech, and then we'll talk about it on the first episode of next year. All right, let us know what you think about that. Meanwhile, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Whose side?
Theme is, these are, because this is the last science or fiction of the year.
Ooh.
Not including the special year in review show. So what I did was I went back and looked at science news items of 2013 that perhaps we missed or we didn't talk about.
Oh boy.
So these could be science news items from any time during 2013.
I like that theme. Rebecca, what do you think about that?
This doesn't bode well.
No, it doesn't. Okay, here we go. Item number one. The NEC Corporation announced it had achieved a wireless transmission record of 1.05 petabits per second. Item number two. Astronomers announced early in 2013 that they discovered seven exocomets. And item number three, Japanese scientists created a transparent zebrafish whose brain glows when active so you can see its thoughts.
Oh, wow! I want to see that.
How did we miss these?
Evan, go first.
A wireless transmission record of 1.05 petabits per second. Bob, is that a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Can you put that into layman's terms, perhaps?
Oh crap!
Is what are you, Kibitzing? Come on!
Yeah, what is happening here?
Okay, I just want it's the last game of the year.
Okay,
so see how far I could get. Okay, but
Bob's
shame
just happily
you.
Going
shame
along.
On you, Bob.
Yeah, Bob's you, just you, happy you. To share his information.
it's like teasing the gorilla behind the cage. Like, hey. All right. Well, I don't know. How am I supposed to know this? I think this is right.
How am I supposed to know stuff?
How am I supposed to know that it didn't beat the record by like 0.1 to, you know, really? I don't keep up to date every day with the new wireless transmission records. Let's just say that. However, that being said, I don't think you're one to screw around with little, you know, numbers like this. You know, it's not going to turn out to be like, no, the record was really 0.09 petabits per second or whatever. So I'm thinking that one's right. The next one about the seven exocomets. First of all, I don't recall this at all. Not that I recall the petabit one either.
Evan, if you had that wireless transmission technology, you would be a pedophile.
We're not allowed to repeat jokes twice.
Now you said pedophile. I said pedophile. Totally different joke.
Oh, you're right. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
It's like tomatoes and tomatoes. What am I thinking? Totally different. Seven exocomets. Is there anything special about this? I imagine astronomers knew these things existed. Okay. So we discovered a few that I imagine they thought were out there anyways to be discovered. And, I don't know. It's cool. It's not, you know, as cool as some of the other items we've talked about, such as glowing brains on transparent zebrafish so you can see its thoughts. Oh my gosh. That's too cool. And there's all sorts of news in 2013 about glowing animals, glowing things, mysterious ocean glowing stuff. We're glowworms, and we're finding out new things about other things that glow. But scientists created this one. Yeah, and they create rabbits that glow and cats that glow in the dark and dogs. So that's entirely plausible. I don't see any problem with that. I'm going to have to say the seven exocomets one is going to wind up being the fiction. I did not hear that at all this year. I don't think that would have gotten by me.
Okay, Bob?
Wireless transmission, 1.05 petabits. That's a quadrillion, by the way, 10 to the 15.
Thank
so,
you.
So, yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. That's amazing.
That's Bob flexing on an audio podcast, by the way. That's his equivalent of...
Yeah, that seems amazingly high, but not as bad as some of the other ones. Let's see, the transparent zebrafish with the glowing brain. Yeah, nothing's leaping out at me, making me think that is ridiculous. I think they could pull that off. But what's getting to me though is this, the second one, the seven exocomets. I'm not buying it for a picosecond. Mainly because they're too damn small. I mean, we can't even see the comets. In our solar system that are in the Oort cloud, what are they, about a light year away? Two light years? I mean, they're really far away. We can't see them, so we're going to see seven that are farther away? No, I don't think so. I mean, gravitational effect? No, they're too small. Some transiting effect? No. I don't think that's not good. They're too small for that too. So yeah, that I'm not buying that one. So fiction, exocomet.
All right, Rebecca.
Oh man. Well, Bob makes a really good case. I was going to dismiss both that and the petabits one as being too boring. And that's why I hadn't heard them.
Did you hear they named the seven exocomets? Dopey, Sleepy, Dot.
Oh, you should have gone Dasher, Dancer. Oh, wait, there's eight of those.
That's eight.
Never mind.
Plus Rudolph.
I was just thinking seasonally. Yeah, so my thinking originally was because I haven't heard of any of these, one of them sounds really fun, and so I feel like I would have heard of it. But the other two sound boring. No, okay. I'm going to get a lot of angry emails over that. How dare Rebecca say that about data transfer? So for that reason, I wanted to go with the zebrafish one. Zebrafish are, I think, they're the fish that are used often in research and because they're transparent. So like they wouldn't have created the transparent zebrafish isn't the part that's surprising because they already are transparent, but the fact that their brain glows when they're like, do they even have brains? I'm not convinced that zebrafish even have brains, but I feel
that would be embarrassing if that turns out to be.
they've got a cluster of 50 neurons.
Right. Yeah, does that count?
Central ganglia, but they don't have a brain.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm thinking. Like, they're zebrafish, for God's sakes.
Come on, didn't you see that freaking Disney movie? I mean, he got lost. He was looking for his son and all that.
That was a clownfish.
Whatever, same thing.
It's a completely different fish.
Oh, it had stripes.
That fish definitely had a brain. Zebrafish, though, I'm not convinced. So for me, it's between the exocomets now, only because Bob made a good argument. And the zebrafish, but I'll be different. I'll go with the zebrafish. Why not?
Alrighty, Jay.
I don't know. The first one is bothering me the most. That's probably because I happen to know the most about that. 1.05 petabits per second. Wireless, Bob. Wireless. I mean, what is it? You know, I mean, even if it were a nanometer away from the transmitter, you know, I think that we might be able to do that fiber optically, maybe. But not wireless. So I'm not quite sure what our fiber optic network can do and what Google's got going on right now, but I don't think wireless is even close to that. Not even close. Especially where I work. So that one aside, which I think that one is the fake, by far and away. So, all right, I heard what Bob said about the exocomets. I just don't know enough. I don't even know how many moons Pluto has. So
five.
What do I know? Thank you, five. So seven. Exocomets, I don't know. I don't, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. I wouldn't even know where to begin to cut that one up.
You did hear me, right?
I heard you, but I'm saying internally I don't have it. And sure, do I trust you over wireless, Bob? Wireless.
I know, that's wacky as well, but this is wackier.
It troubles me that you say that, but is it that big of a deal that they found seven exocomets? What if they were doing a transit in front of some star?
A comet?
In formation.
Yeah, in formation.
In the missing man formation.
Man. So then this one about the transparent zebrafish whose brain glows when active. I adore this news item. I hate to think it's not true because I need to see it and I'm going to Google it right after. If it's real, I want to see it right away. I don't know. I mean, it is kind of weird. That they created that, you know, that I don't like the idea that they're making things see through and then their brain lights up kind of like a heat map type deal, but it is amazingly cool. So I don't know about that one either. It seems kind of far fetched, but possible. I don't know. The only one I know for sure is not true is the wireless 1.05 petabits. Not even
then you're all
close.
Set.
No way. So that's it. Number one.
Yeah. Jay, I agree that's huge. That is insane, but I'm thinking that probably it was, you know, some sort of setup that's maybe expensive or not easy, it can't be mass produced or become commercial, or maybe they can only do it for like, you know, a tiny fraction of a second. So it kind of, is equivalent to 1 petabit a second.
No, Bob, here's where the catch is. It's the computation of transferring the signal, right? It's the sending and receiving parts. It's not the actual line transmission. It's turning it into the signal and then interpreting that signal again. To me, that's the part that I can't possibly see. We're even close to having the technology to do that.
We've got, in
a laboratory?
No, yeah, but even, Evan, it's the devices that are changing the signal to wireless and then unchanging it back and turning it into the wired signal. Those things are not that fast. Those switches or whatever you want to call them, those things don't operate that fast. We don't have anything even close to that. I guarantee you that one is fake.
Okay.
That's pretty strong words, Jay.
We have a guarantee.
Pretty strong words. All right, well, because Jay's being so confident, maybe we'll leave that one till the end.
Oh, I thought you were going to say do it first.
We'll start with number three. We'll go in reverse order. Japanese scientists created a transparent zebrafish whose brain glows when active so you can see its thoughts, and that one is...
Come on, Rebecca!
Sorry, Rebecca.
Science.
Yes!
There's the link. There's the link.
If that one was the fiction, though, and if it was because it didn't have a brain, Steve, oh...
It's a vertebrate. It's a vertebrate. Of course, it has a central nervous system.
I was going to say, okay, I get it. But I mean,
yeah, but you know, wouldn't it be
Japanese
great?
Scientists created this thing without a brain.
Wouldn't it have been great?
Yes. That one is science. Yeah, this is totally uber cool. The transparent zebrafish, it's transparent, so you can see through it. There's just this big blue brain. And as it's thinking about food or whatever, you could see these little bright lights in the brain zipping around. So what they did was they linked.
Oh, Christ. I'm watching the video right now.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it gets activated by the calcium spike that happens when the zebrafish brain
so
cells
weird.
Communicate with each other.
It's so weird. Yeah. Oh, wow. That is crazy.
And so just these little arcs of light. It looks like something from science fiction. It really does. Yep.
Looks like someone's shining a laser pointer at a wall in the dark.
That's the brain, Evan.
I understand. I'm just describing what I'm seeing.
That might be them trying to make the brain think.
Isn't that, that's cool. They got to do that with a person next. It is just a fish. All right. We'll go to number two next. Astronomers announced early in 2013 that they discovered 7 exocomets. Bob and Evan think this one is the fiction. You know, there is an advantage to having a whole year's worth of news items to choose from.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No kidding.
Just 1 week, I'm kind of
Strange. No shit, Steve.
Cuts down the research time probably from like 6 hours.
It was much easier. It was much easier to find 3 cool items when I had the whole year. But I did have to go, do ones that we didn't talk about or that I didn't remember I was talking about. So this one, the exocomets, Bob, you seem pretty certain of yourself that this one.
not as certain as Jay seems.
Steve. I'm pretty confident.
Okay. So you didn't read it. Okay, good.
All right. So the exocomet one is science.
Wow.
Wow.
I can't wait to hear this.
Jay, is this your second solo win in a row?
Wow.
That's right.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well done.
It's lonely at the top.
Ending
the
strong.
Lonely man.
Ending strong, Jay.
Yeah, I did end with a huge pack of balls, I admit.
I ended weak this year. I was doing pretty well. And then like the last 8 weeks,
Steve?
I think I won once.
Well, how do you think?
With a telescope?
I'm gonna stand by what I thought. It was a transit.
It's not the transit. It's by their tails.
Those are long tails.
Shit. didn't think of that one. All right, cool.
Oh, well.
Yeah, so they announced that they had seen 7. Now, this wasn't the first year that they had seen them. The first exocomet was seen in 1987 around Beta Pictoris. 3 more stars with comets turned up before 1998.
Why didn't I think then, of that?
But then the exoplanets started being discovered, and that dominated. But this year, astronomers said they started looking for exocomets again, and they were able to identify 7 likely candidates. And one of the astronomers was so bold as to predict that 2013 would be the year of the exocomet, that it would become more interesting than exoplanets. Of course, exoplanets had a huge year this year, and he was completely wrong in that prediction, in my opinion. But exocomets, still cool. We could, it's still
very cool
that we could, see comets in around other stars. Not surprising, it's never surprising when we find out that our that us, that our situation is typical in our solar system, our planet, et cetera. But, you know, it is nice confirmation that, yeah, there are comets around other stars, not something that's unusual for our solar system.
Which means?
All right. Which means that the NEC Corporation announced it had achieved a wireless transmission record of 1.05 petabits per second is fiction. And Jay, you hit upon the exact reason why it is fiction.
Right,
because the NEC and Corning achieved record-breaking results in optical transmission capacity.
I was right.
It was fiber
Thank
optic.
You.
That's right. It
yeah,
was
I was
a
thinking done. Lasers can switch that fast, but you're right. It's the endpoints that are the problem.
They used a novel multi-core fiber that contains 12 single-mode and 2 few-mode cores by employing the Advanced Space Division multiplexing scheme and optical multi-input, multi-output, or MIMO signal processing technique. So this is a fiber optic breakthrough. But I had to look and see what was the record for wireless. What do you guys think?
1.04 petabits?
2.5 terabits. So
is that all?
Yeah, off by three orders of magnitude, though. Three orders of magnitude.
NEC, they suck.
That's somebody else. That's not even.
Oh, okay, right.
That was, this is from 2012. American and Israeli researchers used the twisted vortex beams to transmit data at 2.5 terabits per second. Oh. I think we talked about that.
Wait, you borrowed a 2012 item to make the.
No. The science one is the pay attention, Evan. Come on, keep up.
No.
The fiber optic is the 2013 item. I just to flesh out my discussion, I wanted to know, what is the record for wireless? And it's the 2.5 terabits. So well done, Jay.
Thank you. I have like most experts, I'm really good at a very few number of things.
Yeah. Thanksgiving.
This and Thanksgiving.
And fiber optics.
And fiber optics.
I love that I am expert at Thanksgiving. I love that.
How about quotes? Are you an expert, Jay, at skeptically themed quotes?
I am.
It's getting there.
Especially when awesome listeners email great quotes into me, like this one. I would never have found this quote. It's a very small quote, but it's a nod to Carl Sagan, so I thought I'd read it to you. The problem with this quote is there are a bunch of names that I have to try to pronounce correctly, and I'm going to fail. So I'm apologizing to Jan now, who sent in the quote. It's Jan Faber-Kerkiewicz. Faber-Kerkiewicz. Thank you, from Poland. And this is a quote by a band called Nightwish, and the song was written by Tuomas Holopainen. Thank you. And the quote is, finally I'm at the quote. The quote is, it's hard to light a candle, easy to curse the dark instead.
Mm-hmm. Ah. It's a classic.
Nightwish!
That quote has got to have an older origin.
Yeah. That's not, the origin is definitely not with them.
Yeah, they may have paraphrased it for their song, but.
Yeah.
Ben Franklin.
Everything is a tribute.
Instead of cursing the darkness, light a candle.
It's also a Castlevania.
It's very
Castle
cool.
Von Wolfenstein.
It's very cool that they quoted him and that it also references Carl Sagan, and apparently it's some type of rock band, which is very cool.
Not because of the candle in the dark. Science is a candle in the dark, yeah. All right, well, guys, this is our last regular show of the year. Next week is our year-end wrap-up episode. George Robb will be joining us for that episode. It's always a lot of fun.
George.
Well, George is a lot of fun, and the year-end wrap-up show is a lot of fun, so it's going to be double fun. And we'll announce, right, Evan? We'll announce the winner of the contest, of the Who's That Noisy contest.
Yes, we will.
That's cool. I'm actually excited about that, Evan. I can't wait to see who we end up with.
Yeah.
And I'll also play the Noisy again, and we can talk a little bit more about it and you know, and talk about the winner as well.
Sounds good. Hey, and don't forget to check out our new memberships. Support the SGU and all the stuff that we do by becoming an SGU member. And you get access to our premium content. Last week's premium content was an interview that we did in 2007 with Christopher Hitchens, which was awesome.
Yeah,
fun. It's a 45-minute interview with Christopher Hitchens, which is now only available as premium content to SGU members.
Yeah, every week we add more premium content. We also send emails to our members, and Also, we're going to be doing interviews of the SGU. Steve's going to interview all of us, and I'm going to interview Steve.
Yeah, so we're going to try to come up with interesting premium content to put up there. If you have any suggestions, let us know. Let it snow? Let us know. And but, yeah, one of our projects we're working on is doing individual interviews. We'll let you know when those go up. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Anytime,
thanks, Doctor.
Steve.
Almost.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. That's not giving me froze to sky. It was never my moose chanting my keep up with you with thoughts along the way. Chase your pussy. Special my moon, you're like a star. We stagger for that.